I think the first thing I need to correct was there was a question related to if the time evolution operator, which we calculated in class, is it valid for relativistic cases? And I'm sorry, I gave an incorrect answer. I think I said that the form should change. There has to be a time evolution operator, but it probably may look something else. But I was wrong there. The same time evolution operator is also valid for relativistic Hamiltonians. And I'll give you the reason why I gave that answer, because I thought maybe the relativistic case has positive and negative energy solutions, positive and negative solutions. And for each of these solutions, the time evolution operator is valid, but maybe when it's acting on both, there are some kind of interferences or something, maybe something, I don't know. I tried to look it up in literature and I did find that my thought was correct. And there are some high research problems where they talk about a phenomena where something weird happens and the same time evolution operator, which we were using in class, may not be valid for the relativistic case. But that's very specific cases. The general answer would be that yes, the time evolution operator, which we used for the is, and we are going to use for Heisenberg picture as well, is going to be valid for relativistic case as well. So I'm really sorry about that. Then there were some questions, like I'll take up these small questions with quick answers before taking up a question, which is more interesting one, the Dyson convergence of Dyson series. I really loved that question. I'll come up with that in the end. So there was one question about distinguishability, and it was very interesting, like to think of every particle is fermion or a boson, like you can classify them. So what are distinguishable particles? Like if everything is fermions and boson, then what is a distinguishable particle? And I think it's a very genuine confusion, but by distinguishability, we mean that you cannot tell whether the particle is a fermion or a boson. So maybe think of two electrons in a box, and they are like, it's a huge box and there are just two electrons somewhere inside. And you don't know that there are electrons, like there are fermions inside the box. You just know that there are two particles inside. How would you know that they are fermions or bosons? Because right now they are like in space somewhere, and if you measure energy of one electron and energy of the second electron, that energy will be exactly same. But if you try to bring them close enough, that kind of their wave functions, they try to overlap, and then you see that since they are fermions, and there's they follow Pauli's exclusion principle, they cannot have exactly same energies. Like one has to be in upspin and other has to be in downspin, something of that sort. So the general like mathematical expression which may determine that whether a particle is distinguishable or indistinguishable would be if the wavelength that is associated with that particle is like very small as compared to the distances between them. I think that like that's a more mathematical thing. But physics wise, I think I don't mean by distinguishability that there's a gas, there are gas molecules, and you can say that this is A and this is B and this is C. That's not possible. That's not distinguishability. By distinguishability, I mean that you cannot tell whether they are bosons or fermions. Okay. They are probably the density is very less or something like that, okay? Does this make sense to you all?
Yep.
Okay. One question which was very common, like at least two of them did ask this question, was they didn't find anything exciting about perturbation theory, and why is there a need for a theory? And I would say that my half of my research work is based on perturbation theory. So among all of the topics which I'm discussing in this lecture, in these coursework, they're really new to me. I mean, you could have sensed that I'm teaching them for the first time probably, but perturbation theory is something that which I have been using for a long time. So perturbation theory is something exciting for me, and I want you all to feel the same excitement when it comes to perturbation theory. And I'll give you one, I'll ask you a question probably. Like when you have hydrogen atom and you try to solve the Schrodinger. So I'm an atomic physicist, so I'm going to talk mostly about atoms. And if I ask you to solve the Schrodinger equation for hydrogen atom, forget about the relativistic version, just the non-relativistic one. You can easily do that, right? You have done that. You have solved the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues for Schrodinger, for these hydrogen atoms, right? So I can share the screen and then write a very simple Hamiltonian for just one atom above hydrogen. Like if I write.
Sorry, Vidya, I don't think your page is shared. We're just seeing your face. Oh, okay.
Okay. It took some time, yeah. So this equation, you know how to solve, right? And just ignore small, silly mistakes, which I usually make. I'm so sorry about that. You can solve it. But now, if I go just, so I'll call this as maybe H, okay? Excluding these size, okay? And if I just go one atom up in periodic table and talk about helium atom, the Schrodinger equation for helium atom looks something like this. So these H are these one body Hamiltonian for each of the electrons. So H1 has these delta ones and these R ones, okay? Now, if I ask you to solve this exactly, you won't be able to do that. I mean, can you think of a way of handling this Hamiltonian exactly the way you did for hydrogen atom?
I'm sorry, did you mean H1 and H2 there?
Yeah, H1, H2. Yes. So, yeah. Can you think of any method, numerical technique or analytical technique, anything which help you solve this equation? And this is just two electrons we are talking about. Because the problematic term here is this inter-electronic repulsion. You cannot solve this equation exactly. I mean, I have seen some literature where they have tried to do that, but it's too complicated. So this is where perturbation theory, where I appreciate perturbation theory. And what we do is we solve these one body, one particle Hamiltonians and know the solution and then include this small interaction between electrons perturbatively and do the correction. So this is where perturbation theory is exactly very, very useful. This is one of the examples, and there are a lot of other applications as well. I'll give you a philosophical, maybe picture of this perturbation theory, which was one of the questions, but just to make you appreciate, if I try to calculate these energy eigenvalues for helium atom without including this inter-electronic repulsion, I get for ground state, I get this energy. The actual experimental value is this. Okay. And if try to include first order perturbation, this value comes much, much closer to the experimental value. So this is just including first order perturbation. If I just include the second order perturbation, it comes much even closer to the experimental values. And 13th order of perturbation gives me exactly the same result as the experimental values. Like, there are other approximate methods which could you use, but I haven't seen any method as accurate as the perturbative method to find properties of systems which match with the real experimental values. Do you think it's exciting enough? Like, for me, it's exciting enough. I can do a lot of things just by using perturbation theory. So I know the partial system. I know how to solve it. I don't know a little bit part of it. I just include it perturbatively because I cannot solve it exactly. Yeah, it's almost kind of impossible. Just solving this requires three coordinates and And solving this would require, like, I don't know how many, three and three. Yeah, at least six coordinates. So that's really complicated. And philosophically, perturbation theory tells you, so when we were writing those equations, if you remember, each equation had this kind of matrix element. So with each perturbation, we were adding one more matrix element and so on. So philosophically, perturbation theory is just not like diagonalizing and finding out the eigenvalues. It's more like it shows that if I have a system and I apply a perturbation, or maybe the perturbation was included in the system itself, I just didn't know how to include it. Like, for example, this is not an external perturbation. It's present in the system. I just don't know how to include this in my solution. So I use perturbation theory to include it. So philosophically, if a system is there and there's an external small perturbation, it would mean that I'm trying to find out all the pathways the system would undergo, like all these transitions. Like, if it's in ground state, then it might go to some of the intermediate states and so on, like something like Dyson series. So it's kind of give you all the possible pathways the system can undergo if under influence of some kind of potential. And maybe you're going to cover it more when you do relativistic quantum mechanics in those Feynman diagrams, which are nothing but these perturbations, including perturbations, like, kind of. And someone wanted a more like thorough book where perturbation theory is given in more rigorous details. And I have been following Sakurai and Griffiths, but if you want more details, then there's a book by Cohen. I'm not sure if I'm going to spell it correctly. Cohen Tanoji, you probably might have heard. And there's one by Branston and Geochain. So they have book on quantum mechanics and atomic physics both. It does give a lot of stuff regarding to perturbations, okay? Can I go to the next question?
Can I ask something quickly? Sorry?
Yes, please.
In the example you said about Feynman diagrams, the thing is that in the end, they are not enough, and sometimes you have non-perturbative effects that they mm-hmm. doesn't like they are not able to explain them. In these examples you are telling us about atomic physics, is there something similar to that? Some non-perturbative thing that you are not able to study using perturbation theory?
So is your question that using Feynman diagrams you try to study something? Can you repeat it? I mean, yeah, that's not very much clear to me. The question is not much clear to me.
Sorry, I repeat it quickly. Sorry. Sometimes there are effects that you cannot study perturbatively because they are like, purely non-perturbative, because maybe the coupling constant, you cannot say that it is small and the approximation doesn't hold.
Yes.
My question is, in your examples, and you have told us that in your work, what you use is perturbative theory. Are there like some systems in which you are not able to use that, or it always
Yes. Yes. Yeah, there's a condition, and I think we did in class that there's some equation that perturbation has to satisfy in order that I apply perturbation. But interesting that you asked this. There are alternate approximate methods. Like in my work, I usually use Hartree-Fock theory, which is an alternate to this variational principle and these perturbation methods. But it's not as accurate as perturbation theory, if I'm allowed to use perturbation theory. Like there are constraints. For Hartree-Fock, there's no constraint. I could use it for any kind of system, even if the potential is large, I think. Yeah, I think I'm right. But like not too large that it destroys the system, but fairly like in the middle range or something like that. But I usually use something called Hartree-Fock method and mean field approximations for that. But you are right, there are constraints where I cannot apply perturbation theory to the system.
Could you give an example?
For a large perturbation?
Because it doesn't matter how large it is, I think, as long as it is in proportion to the actual Hamiltonian lesson one.
Yes, you could, that's...
You could expand as much as you want to the nth order until you get a convergent result. So it basically depends on the convergence of the Dyson series.
Yes, I think we did that condition. If you're talking about the same thing, that I don't remember it exactly, but it had something to do with the energy differences or something like that. I don't remember it exactly. But this condition, it's not just enough saying that perturbation is small, but there are two conditions, and probably, yes, including these perturbative terms to a large number of terms in series might help, but it won't help if your perturbation is really large. I mean, I think that's the criteria for that. So it will become diverging. There has to be a criteria that it should converge, right? Just including lots and lots of them won't help. I'm coming to the Dyson series, by the way.
But what would the condition be exactly? Because in the lecture notes and in the quiz, you said lambda v is much less than the difference between the energy levels. But I think the condition is kind of a subsection of all the conditions that the perturbation theory could be used in. Because the perturbation theory could be used for, let's say, the lambda V is equal to half of the energy difference, which is not much less than one, but still less than one.
But you'll have to see how many, maybe it is, I'm not sure, I'll have to find and then see. But how are you sure that for that particular condition, your series is going to diverge? If you include
the question in that regard as well, my question was that is it possible for the Dyson series not to not diverge or converge but just oscillate?
I think that I'm still sticking to my physical picture when I said for Dyson series that I think it should converge mathematically. I could not prove that mathematically it should convert. I tried to find out a little mathematical proof as well. But I think that Dyson series should always converge. But otherwise, if it oscillates or it diverges, it should not represent a physical system. Like in our case, we are using Dyson series to explain time evolution of a system, right? And if my system is moving from one state to another state at different times, it kind of signifies a physical process. And how can I explain a physical process if the operator explaining it is diverging? And I don't think it should also oscillate. That's my answer. I mean, you are free to differ, but I don't find it convincing that Dyson series should be diverging or oscillating. It should converge. By the way, you're going to use Dyson series for relativistic part as well. And Dan is going to cover the same. probably it would be a nice idea if I could ask Dan, because I'm teaching Dyson series for the first time. So I've never taught or I have never learned that during my undergrad and grad studies. So I might be wrong. And whatever explanation I'm giving, it's just the reading and the interpretation of what I'm reading. Okay. So maybe I can also ask Dan about this. Okay. Is that okay?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, okay. But yeah, I really stick to my point. I'm so sorry. But you're free to do that as well. I mean, you can stick to your point. And we can have a nice discussion sometime in person if I'm there. Okay. So I'm coming to convergence of Dyson series. That was a question and it really interests me a lot. Probably even after I stop teaching it, I'll probably look into it in more details because this is something interesting. So when we were doing Dyson series and we were trying to find a solution for our time evolution operator, we said that it can be written as, by the way, you were right in my nth term, that was not nth, that was n plus one nth term. So I've corrected that in notes as well.
Thank you.
Okay, and then there was and more terms here. Before I start, I gave you the physical reason why I think that it should converge, because if it's representing a physical process, to me it doesn't make any sense that it should not converge, okay? A more rigorous mathematical proof before I start that. What came to my mind was that if my Hamiltonian is time independent or it commutes at different time, we said that this so this series, this exponential, it represents the solution, right? Can you just tell me if this series is convergent or divergent? Is the exponential of a quantity convergent or divergent?
There's an integral on the LHS as well.
There's an integral here. Yep. but did I miss some kind of integral? I'm sorry. There's an integration here.
In the exponential, I'm asking, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm taking a case for time-dependent Hamiltonians. Like for time independent, this integration will just change to h.
I mean, I think he means that the exponential also should be an integral form.
The exponent should also be an integral.
When you bring e to the power of I h t over h bar, it means that h is not a power, is not a function of t.
H is a function of t. So I'm just writing the solution for you. So this is you. Maybe I should just remove the integration if that makes you comfortable. Yeah, or maybe do it the other way because I need this integration. So I'm writing this as, so in the power also there's an exponent. Okay, yeah. Now is that fine?
Yeah.
just exponential of a quantity, the series, if I express it, is that series convergent or divergent?
Should be.
I think it's convergent. Convergent, because yeah, the radius of convergence of exponential is infinity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was, because I am not much, I mean, I've admitted that with mathematics, I am not very much sure, so I don't know how to prove the convergence. Like mathematically, I just saw these factorials here. So these factorials are kind of making the series convergent. There might be other mathematical rigorous proof for that. Okay, so this Hamiltonian here is just an expansion, right? So I'm expanding these powers here, okay? So this represents my exponent. Now, for my Dyson series, I wrote my solution, if you remember, was something like this. It had missing factorials. So it was something like this, TT primes. So I've chosen T not as zero, just to make things simpler. And so on, okay? Now, the series, if you look at it, it may be divergent, convergent, I don't know, depends on this Hamiltonian here. But if I had some factorials here that would look something similar to my exponent series, and it would converge, right? And if you remember during our lectures, we said that this series, it changes to the exponent series for the cases when my Hamiltonian is time independent and it does not, it commute, the Hamiltonian at a different time, it commutes. So if I'm able to prove that there are some kind of factorials here, or this Dyson series can be written in this form, will you be convinced that the Dyson series, if I take all the infinite terms here, it should converge?
Yes.
Yes or no? Yeah, okay. So I'll try to do that. That's what I tried to do, and I kind of succeeded to do that. So I just tried to see if I can write this as this, or maybe introduce some kind of factorials or something like that, okay? So I'll just work with the third term here and the third term of the series, and then try to prove that they are kind of same, and then maybe higher order terms need more effort. So I'll just consider this integral, okay? I'll write it, that's J1 and and I'll just replace. What I'll do is, because I want to draw these T's and T primes on the X and Y axis, so I'm more comfortable using replacing T primes by X, okay? So that's my X axis, and T double primes by Y, okay? Because it will be much easier to imagine them on a Cartesian coordinate system. So I can write this as 0 to t dx, 0 to x, because this was t prime, dy, h, x, and h. Okay? And if you look at this integration, what does this represent? So I have x's and y's. It represents that when my x goes from, so my upper limit is t, it cannot go beyond t, like x and y both. And when my x goes from 0 to 1, my y also goes from 0 to 1. So maybe this is 1, and y also goes from 0 to 1. And when x goes from 0 to 2, y also goes from 0 to 2, and so on. So something like this. this is my x is equal to 0. And this integration. So when it goes from 0 to 3, y also goes from, x goes from 0 to 3, y also goes from 0 to 3, and so on. So this integration kind of represents this triangle, OK? Do you all agree with that?
Yeah.
And this is the region where x is greater than y. So this is this region. X is more than y. And this line is x equal to y. So my h's are time order, like the time which is appearing on the left-hand side has is less than the right-hand side is less than the time appearing on the front, OK? So x is more than y. Now let's consider another integral. Now my integration limit goes from x to t, OK? Now, I'm writing y here before y because if you see, my y is almost always greater than x, right? Because the integration limit for y is from x to t. So in this case, y is more than x. So I've written, I'm just kind of time ordering my Hamiltonians, okay? Now, if I draw this integral on my xy plane, can you tell me what part of, I already gave a hint, kind of hint, what part of this picture is going to represent this area, this integral?
The upper
triangle.
Upper triangle. Yes, because when, in this case, if you see, when my x goes from 0 to 1, my y goes from 1 to t, right? So when x goes from 0 to 1, y goes from 1, which is somewhere here, to t. And then when x goes from 1, 0 to 2, my y goes from 2 to t, and so on. So it's going to represent this upper triangle area. And I think it's easy to see that these integrals should be equal. This area should be equal, right?
Yeah.
So I can just add them up and then say that it's 2j. And if I add these two integrals, I'll get 0 to t dx. And yeah, so here I have 0 to x dy hx hy plus t, y. Now, I'm going to introduce an operator called the time ordering operator. So in this integral, my x and y's are already ordered the way I want them. So I'll say that yeah, they are already time ordered. And in here, since y is more than h, I'll write x first and y first, and then introduce this operator called the time ordering operator. So this is time ordering operator. OK. This just means that y is happening before x. The other way around. OK. Now, if you see these integrations, I can easily write j as 1 over 2, 0 to t dx, 0 to t, because I'm adding these integrations. And this is something equal to my second, like third term in this exponent series. And if I include the third term, like with three integrals, I'll get a 3D kind of graph, which is a little difficult, but not that much. Like maybe it needs a little more effort. But if I include my third integral as well, I'll get 1 over 3 factorial in the denominator. Like I'll have these integrals I hear, there are two integrals which have same area. There I'll have three factorial integrals which have same area. So if you see that Dyson series could be kind of expressed in the same series form for an exponential. So mathematically, if this is a convergent series, if I include all these terms in my series for U, it should also represent a convergent series. But yeah, I don't know if this satisfies you. That was Ali, right? Ali and Vincent had asked me that question.
I think me and DJ.
It's not me.
It was DJ, Dongjin.
I'm sorry?
It was me and Dongjin.
Oh, Dungeon or DJ. DJ is much more comfortable. Okay. Yeah, so I won't mind if you still don't agree with me. And you might be right. I mean, I might be wrong, but I don't see any logical error in my thought process. And if you can find some, just let me know.
What did you do with the time order operator for the first term, for the left-hand term? The integral over 0 to x? How did that appear there as well?
This time order? I just time ordered. See, if this is just time order. By the way, there's a document showing exact these calculations on the portal if you are interested. But since my y is greater than x, I'm just introducing a operator called time order, which does the same thing. It brings this Hamiltonian to this Hamiltonian because y is more than x, like, yeah.
Okay, and if it isn't, it just leaves it unchanged?
If they are not commuting, then there's a difference between them. If they're commuting, yeah, then I don't need this time ordering. Yeah. If they.
Oh, so for the first time,
then I just remove.
X is greater than y. It's identity.
Oh, in first term, I can just write now, right? Because this is already time ordered. So if I just write t, it won't harm. It's already time ordered. Like x is greater than y for the first term.
But so you concluded that because j here is half of the integral that you've just written, this basically means that the Dyson series converges because it's less than the exponential for the case that Hamiltonians commute?
No, not that. What I try to show here is, maybe let's just forget about the case where Hamiltonians are not commuting, okay? Let's just see if Hamiltonians are commuting. So if Hamiltonians are commuting, then I just can get rid of this and write this expression. And it very well matches with my third term in the series for exponential, right? So what I'm trying to show here is that whatever I got from my Dyson series is exactly equal to the exponential series. And since exponential series is converging, if I include all these terms in my Dyson series, all these terms, then it should also converge.
But in the exponential term, you have terms of 1 over n factorial.
Yeah. So if I include,
you don't.
Now here also, if you just include the third term, like this one with h ones, there is going to be a 3 factorial. And if you include the fourth Hamiltonian, they're going to be 4 factorial and so on.
The only problem I have with this is the time operator, time order operator. Doesn't that make any difference at all? So if that's...
Yeah, I thought so. I mean, that was the exact question I had in mind. But then I thought maybe the number of Hamiltonians is same, right? Time ordering is just an operator which is making Hamiltonians here and there, that's all. So it should not affect the convergence of the terms. That's what I thought.
Yeah, so
maybe
so
there's a better.
If the integral after the effect of the time order operator converges, we are concluding that the integral that does not have the time order operator, it converges as well.
Okay, maybe I can just put it this way, that I have these factorials, because the reason why I thought this exponential should converge is because there are these factorial terms. So doesn't matter what I have in the numerator, like I can have a quantity. So if I try to expand a quantity in series, which is more than one or less than one, as long as these factorials are there, this exponential series always converges. So
because in the
if you're not
well, you couldn't replace the whole problem was that H's did not commute. If they did, you would have been all set. But because they didn't commute, you couldn't actually calculate the integrals that easily. And here
Yes. You
have somehow assumed that by implementing the effect of the time order operator on the J's, I guess, it doesn't change the result, the resulting equation.
No, I have not made that assumption. No. There's something you're misunderstanding. I have not made that assumption as far as I think. Because here still I'm taking integration over y first and then x first. But when I take this integration and add up to this integration and then take it over x, the whole thing gives me two times of j. I'm not making that assumption that I'm saying that I can change the order of h, no. Okay, maybe if you're still not convinced, I'll be really happy, and I'm just saying that to say that, but I'll be really happy to discuss it more because this really interested me a lot. Okay? Anything else, if we can quickly, if there are some quick questions, because I need to move ahead with today's lecture.
Oh, thank you.
Let's move ahead.
Yeah.
Learn about density operators. I meant that in the most respectful possible way.
Okay, but before density operator, we have to finish the Heisenberg picture. But Ali, I really appreciate the questions, kind of questions. I mean, not you, just everyone is asking. This is really adding so much that I'm learning, especially this Dyson series. I loved it. I mean, I have never seen it before. This is the first time I've seen it, and I never thought it could be so interesting. Okay, so can we start with the Heisenberg picture and then come to the density metrics part? Okay, so if you remember when we introduced Schrodinger picture, before doing that, I said that there are two ways that these observables could be defined, like time-dependent observables could be defined. One was where we are including that my states, they were time dependent, and the other was so the other was when I said that I could include my time dependence or this unitary operator which is causing this time evolution in my operator. So this is Schrodinger picture and this is Heisenberg picture. We are going to work with these Heisenberg picture today, but I want to draw a comparative chart to just show how things look like in Schrodinger and Heisenberg picture. So this is Schrodinger picture and this is Heisenberg picture. Or maybe I can do that later, but let me introduce Heisenberg picture, okay. So there are two quantities. One is state gets. And the other is the operators or the expectation value of operators which are observables. Okay. Now, at time t naught, so when t is equal to t naught, in Heisenberg picture, my state is going to look like this, and I'm just going to write h to make it distinguishable. And at a later time, it should not evolve. Okay, so it should stay same, and it should stay same as the Schrodinger picture kept at time t naught. Okay. For operators, my at time t is equal to t naught, the operator at t naught should represent my this Schrodinger picture and t naught. And since there is no time dependence, I'll just avoid writing it, or maybe just write it, it doesn't matter. And in Heisenberg picture, this operator is going to evolve like this. Okay. And if I want to find out how the, so this is the relation between state ket in Heisenberg picture at time t and the Schrodinger picture at the initial time. But if I want a relation between the state kets in these two pictures at the same time, I would just use this. I mean, this is quite obvious because the state kets in Schrodinger picture, they are evolving, right? At a later time, they are evolving like this. We have seen during our last lecture. So if I just bring it here, this is how state kets in two pictures at same time are related, okay? All right. Now, if our state kets are not changing with time, like, they are remaining same as these, there's no sense in studying the time evolution of these state kets, which we did for Schrodinger picture. Like for Schrodinger picture, we had time evolution. And then if I just multiply it by alpha naught, I get a Schrodinger equation. So this was the time, motion equation of motion for the Schrodinger picture. For Heisenberg picture, it makes more sense to study the equation of motion for my operators because they are evolving in time. So that's something which we should always keep in mind while working with Heisenberg picture, that we are mostly interested about how operators are in Heisenberg picture instead of the state kets. Okay, so I can find out the equation of motion for any operator A in Heisenberg picture by just taking time derivative of this equation here. And if I do that, I get a very nice looking familiar equation, okay? And since my A's are not dependent on time, the third term does not appear. And I know the time evolution of these du by dt's, we had written that equation. If I write that down, I'll get So this is just the time evolution equation which I just used. And this one is the dagger of that equation. So if I now introduce u U daggers here because they are identity. I can write this equation as so U dagger HU is going to become the Hamiltonian in the Heisenberg picture. That's the definition of how our operators, they propagate, like how they are dependent on a time evolution operator. And U dagger ASU becomes my operator in Heisenberg picture. And same thing here, I write AH and HH, which is a very nice looking equation. So I'll write time dependence here. So these are time dependent. Now, if my Hamiltonian is not time dependent, right? So there's no sense writing these H's here. They're going to remain the same. So I'm doing a very specific case for time independent Hamiltonians. And we are going to see what to do if Hamiltonians are time dependent in our interaction pictures, okay? So I can write my equation as this equation here is called my Heisenberg equation of motion, which gives the time evolution of these operators. And solution for this is right here. So this is the solution for this. Okay. And I can write any operator in, like I can write time evolution of any operator in this Heisenberg picture. And there's a related problem in your tutorial. Like, remember yesterday's tutorial, you did precession of spin using Schrodinger picture, like how those state gets, they evolve with time when we apply magnetic field. In tutorial tomorrow, we are going to repeat the same exercise, but this time you're going to use Heisenberg picture. So this should be your starting equation, okay? And for example, in tomorrow's tutorial, you are probably going to use the equation of motion for a spin. Okay, something like this. So you should know these operators and you already know them for your like poly exclusion, poly spin matrices and so on. Okay, that's all actually, this is it. This is all you need to know Heisenberg picture. Just remember that the observables, they remain same in Heisenberg and Schrodinger picture, like the propagation. Yeah, so these expectation values, they remain same. Whether, and those are the real observables, those are the real quantities which you measure in experiments. Okay, that's it about Heisenberg picture. Any questions before we move to density matrices or density operators? I'm excited about that topic.
I think
maybe you'll have more. Yes.
I think we're good on questions.
Oh, great, great. Nice. Maybe probably you'll have more with the tutorials one, yeah. But okay, I think we need maybe a 2 minutes break before we start with something.
Thank you.
Yep, and how many of you have done density matrices or density operators? Like, oh, great. Ah, nice.
Yeah.
That's great.
Sparkling machine regular.
And when I say that you have seen density matrices, like you have really used them in systems or just know the basics? Because what we are going to cover is mostly the basics, like not too much about density. Whatever we are going to do, we are going to use them for open quantum systems. So a question about lifestyle there. Are you all living on campus or you're allowed to stay outside as well?
Living in University of Waterloo housing.
The ultimate question is not whether it's on time, but whether it meets with...
We're living in a University of Waterloo.
We're living in University of Waterloo housing.
It's like a 10-minute walk from the perimeter.
I'm sorry. Again, a lot of noise. I couldn't hear the answer very clearly. So you are allowed to stay outside the campus?
We are all staying on campus.
No. Okay. 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 That's clear. Yeah.
We're all on the same floor, the same dorm. All of us.
But it's nice to stay on campus, I think. I'll always prefer staying on campus because there's more interaction with your peers. I mean, yeah, there are pros and cons of both.
We have lots of jam sessions with guitars and singing and just other instruments.
I don't know. Not many other instruments, actually. Just guitars.
Wow, that's nice. That's interesting, I guess. Yeah. Probably I'll get my visa soon, but that should not be before the course ends. My last lecture is on Monday, by the way. And we have our last tutorial on Tuesday. And then Dan is going to teach you the relativistic part in person. Okay? And probably it's a good idea to discuss Dyson series with him before that. Can we start with the density matrices?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. So some of you already are familiar with density matrices. And I'm going to use density matrix and density operator, like back and forth, but it would mean the same. I mean, this is more in Kett and Bra notation, and this is more in a matrix form, but they are almost same, okay? So I'm going to use both these terms back and forth. I'll kind of oscillate between these two terms, okay? Not periodically. So this is just an alternate, I would say, representation of your states in quantum systems, like we have done a number of other representations as well. You can represent your states in these bracket notations. You can give them those functional forms, something of this sort, or probably other ones. I can't think of many. But there are a number of ways to represent the same physical quantum system, and density matrix is one of them. It represents a physical system, and it has a lot of advantages. Firstly, it's more practical, okay? And when I say practical, probably I don't need the whiteboards. When I stop sharing the whiteboard, can you all see me?
Yeah.
Okay. So while I'm doing talking, I'll probably not share my screen. Okay. So while doing theoretical calculations, we usually talk about a single state, right? We just talk about psi of a function. But when we work in experiments, there's nothing called a single state, right? If I give you a state and then ask you to find the state, I give you a single system and I ask you to find the state of that system experimentally, it won't make any sense to you because it's going to collapse in either of the eigenfunctions for that system, right?
Yeah.
So experimentally, when you do experiments, you need lots and lots of, like maybe copies, I won't say, but you need lots of atoms and lots of systems. So this is where density matrix comes into picture because you need a kind of statistical data. So if I give you a lot of silver atoms and I ask you just find what's the spin state of that silver atoms, what you're going to do is you're going to probably measure one, measure two, second, third, and fourth, and find out a statistical data and then tell me, okay, so 30% of these atoms were in upspin and 70% were in downspin, something of like that. So this is where density matrix comes into picture because it kind of gives you information about the statistical mixtures. And it's used in a number of approaches, especially when the system is interacting with the environment. I mean, you could use wave functions as well, but it makes more sense to use density metrics, which will be more clear when we do open quantum systems. And formally, the way we define density matrices are, So this is by definition that a density matrix, usually written as rho, is represented as this, okay? So the notation which I'm going to use in this lecture is alphas are going to be my state gets. And I'm going to use the fact that they are in one of these eigenbases. And we are mostly going to talk about a two-level system. So mostly like spins up or down. So n is only from 1 to 2. And for up spins, I'm going to use this representation. And in matrix form, I'll use 0, 1. And for down, I'm going to use 1, 0, okay? And you are hopefully familiar with this representation as well. So this is by definition my density matrix. So this density matrix very well can represent this up spin, okay? Can everyone quickly write the density matrix for the up spin state? Just matrix multiplication. So I'll do it, but I want you all to do it as well. So did you get a matrix something like this?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So this density matrix exactly represent my up spin. And I'll tell you how these matrix elements here give me information about the system. So if I ask you to find out the probability that my system is in up state, okay, all you're going to do is you're going to probably find out this expectation value. So if I give you density matrix, this, and I ask you to find out the probability of finding the system in up state, you are just going to find out this matrix element, which here is 1. And that was the state to start with. My system was in up spin. And similarly, if I ask you to find what is the probability that system is in down spin, you'll directly say by looking at these matrix elements that, oh, my system cannot be in down spin. So these matrix elements, they give you the information about the system. And these off-diagonal matrix elements tell you something interesting, which these single states sometimes miss. So we are going to cover that in like coming few minutes, probably, hopefully today. Probably not today. Okay, but these off-diagonal matrix elements have a special meaning as well, okay? Now, let's consider another state. Now, this state has two kind of, let's consider a system which has two different kind of states, okay? That it has two members which can be represented by different state gets, okay? So let's have a system of, let's say, n electrons, okay? And out of these n electrons, my n up, like there is a number of, these number of electrons are in up state, up spin, and these number of electrons are in down spin, okay? Now the fractional population or statistical probability of both these two spin states, I'll write them as W's, would be like probability that the system is in, and this probability is the statistical probability, okay, for my system is, and for down is this. Now let's say that this beam, which I'm talking about, these electrons, it's unpolarized, like the spins are unpolarized, okay? And it's completely like unpolarized, which means that the number of up spins is same as the number of down spins, okay? So half of them are in and up, and half of them are in and down. So this is like one half, and this is one half. Okay. Now the general density matrix for this system would be, by definition, not just alphas. This was when I had a system consisting of only one kind of states. Now, for system which has like mixture of number of states, number of different states, my density matrix is written as, this has this statistical probability as well, okay? So for this particular system, I would say, and there's a sum over alpha. Since there are two kinds of states, I would say that density matrix for this kind of system is W up, and in up state, W downs, in down states. Okay. And these W's here are the statistical probabilities, which should always sum up to one. Okay. So W up, plus W down, should be equal to one, which in this case is true, like half are in up and half are in down. Now, can you write the density matrix for this? I'll write it down. You also write it down and then see if I'm correct or not. So up was, yep. Okay. What do you get?
Half of I.
Yeah. I, yes. Half of I. So this kind of system, which has, which is a collection of like systems consisting of two different states, this is called a mixture, okay? And the earlier example where we had just one kind of system, where I knew that 100% probability of the system is to be in one particular state, they are called pure systems, okay? This is a mixed state, and this is a pure state, okay? Pure system or pure state is more appropriate, I guess. Mixture or a mixed state. And we'll come up with more explanation about these mixed and pure states, like how to identify them by looking at these matrices. Just to summarize, pure state is defined as members where each member is characterized by the same state alpha, okay? And a mixture is characterized by if I have like W1 in this and W2 in, I'm sorry, and so on, okay? I need some water, I'm sorry. Okay, so my question is, can you tell me if I have a system where my spins are in this state, like I have 100 of them and they all are in this state, is it a pure or a mixed state? This would represent a pure state. Because I know that there's no statistical uncertainty associated with the system. My system, there's 100% probability that all the spins are in superposition of up and down, okay? And I'll show you mathematically that how can you show that this is a pure system. But do you need more discussion with this? Because it might confuse.
Well, that makes sense.
I'm sorry?
I said that makes sense. I don't think there's any questions.
Okay. Great. Okay. So let's write down. Yeah, one more thing I want to point out here is that when we are talking about these like ensembles or systems, pure and mixed state, for mixed state, it's not necessary that the eigen basis or basis set for my alpha 1 and alpha 2, they are orthonormal, okay? So if I have a mixture of alpha 1s and alpha 2s with some statistical probabilities associated with them, it's not necessary that so if I can write them in terms of their basis set, it's not necessary that this is true, okay? For example, I'll give an example regarding that. So for this pure state, imagine a beam of electrons where 30% of them are in spin up state in x direction, and 70% of them are in spin down with in z direction. So the basis for these two, it does not, they are not orthonormal. So it's not necessary, okay? They could be in different bases. But yeah, within this, so this should be orthonormal. Okay. Let's do some properties quickly for these density matrices. First is that these density matrices, they are Hermitian. And it's quite obvious from their definition why they should be Hermitian. Like if I take a dagger of this, I'll end up with the same density matrix, okay? Second is that if my state gets, they are normalized. Then the trace of my density matrix is always one. Trace of my rho is always one. Okay. And I can prove that. So this is the definition of my trace, diagonal matrices, and then summing them up. And if I introduce the definition of my rows, I can write it as.
You didn't need the sigma alpha again.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yes, 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 yes. Yep, okay. Is that, I couldn't hear, but yeah, I noticed. What's that the problem you were pointing out?
Yeah.
But okay. And this is nothing but my coefficients, right? In for my state get alphas. And if it's normalized, then this should be equal to one. And I know that I said that the statistical probabilities should also be equal to one. So this is equal to one. And my statistical probabilities also sum up to be equal to one. So that means trace of my density matrix should always be one. And you can see that, like, even if it's a pure mixed state, here my diagonal, like the trace is one. Even for pure states, the first example, the trace was one, okay? So this is in general true that if my state gets are normalized, then the density matrix has to be, the trace has to be one. The third important property for these, maybe before going to third, let me say that, just quickly make a remark that these density operators, they are positive definite operators. Like these quantities here in matrices, they are always positive, okay? It won't make sense to have these numbers as negative the way they are defined, because they define kind of populations and coherences. So they cannot be, coherence sizes, I'm not sure about, but these diagonal elements, they cannot be negative. They have to be positive, okay? So density operator is a positive definite operator by definition, okay? The next important property that could be the fourth one is that trace of square of my density matrix or density operator is always less than or equal to one. And this actually gives me a well-defined mathematical criteria to distinguish between my pure and mixed states. Okay, let's first see that this is true and then see which condition gives me information about pure state and which gives a mixed state. Okay? So trace of rho square, I can write it as rho square, and I'm just going to introduce the definition for alphas. I just wrote rho square as rho, product rho, and so this for this row, the associated statistical probability. And for this row, I'm using alpha primes, associated probabilities. Now, assuming that my system has like orthonormal states, which is not always true, as I said. But yeah, if they are not, one comment I forgot to make, like in this case, I said that it's not necessary that they are orthonormal, the basis set for the two states. But when I'm working and when I'm trying to make the density matrix, I have to write one of these in terms of the other. Like we can do that, right? I can write SZ in terms of SX and vice versa. Okay, so I'm assuming that this is orthonormal. Or maybe, yeah, orthogonal, which gives me delta alpha alpha, and I can write, fine. And this again reduces to, and this gives me something like, okay, so trace of rho square is sum over alphas, and these statistical probabilities squared and then added together. And I can write, I can say that this has to be always less than or equal to alpha squares. Right, which means that trace of rho square should always be less than or equal to trace of rho. So this is rho squared trace, and this is trace of rho squared. And this, since this is one, I can say that this quantity here is always less than or equal to one. And for pure states, trace of rho and trace of rho square, they are one. This is one of the ways to check if your state is pure or not. And yeah, it's like pretty much easy to see that if my pure state is defined as this without any statistical probabilities here, rho square is going to be defined as this quantity, which is again equal to rho. So their trace has to be equal, right? This is pure state. And this is the maximum value my trace of rho squared can have. For all values which are less than one, we have a mixed state. So for mixed states, we have base of rho squared less than one. Okay. So maybe we can check our previous two examples, and I can give you two more examples before we finish the class. Yeah. Okay. Two quick examples to check if they are pure or mixed state. So this was our mixed state, right? So for this mixed state, if I take trace of rho squared, so my rho is this quantity. If I take square of it, I would get something like 1/4, 1/4. And if I take trace of it, it's less than one. Okay. And if I look at my first example, which was representing a pure state, here, trace of rho squared is equal to one. And that's interesting because I think for most of the pure states, you'll have only one non-zero diagonal element, which would be one. Yeah, okay. I'll quickly give you any questions before I give you two more problems to work, and then we can end the class. Any questions with all this? Like, it's pretty much basic and very much easier. I don't see any I don't see any physics in here right now, but yeah. Okay, I'll give you two questions, and probably you can tell me if they represent a pure or a mixed state, okay? So check if that was the question which I asked, that check if I have a superposed state of ups and downs. No, we didn't make a density matrix of it. Yeah, so can you make a density matrix of this? And then actually see that this is going to represent a pure state. Okay. And once you are done, just let me know. I can give you the next problem.
Vindhya?
Yes.
Hi. It will be half with all the entries one.
If will?
In the matrix. Half. And all the entries will be one in the matrix.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, that was quick. So probably the row which you have got should be this quantity. And now, did you get this thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Now just check what's rho square and then take trace of this. It should be equal to one. So this is one example where, the diagonal, two of the diagonal elements are non-zero. Yeah. Did you all get trace of rho square as one?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe a system where 50% of the spins are in up and 50% are in Z down. Yeah, so like the statistical weights associated with them is 1/2 and 1/2. This is going to represent a pure state.
That would be half outside and 2, 1, 1, 1.
Sukanya, can you? Yeah, I think everyone might have figured it out. But would it be possible for you to share what you got? Like, I'm sure you're using some kind of notes, but if you can show them on the screen.
Actually, I didn't write it down.
Oh, you didn't write it down? That's okay.
Also, I had a suggestion, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a little trivial, but if possible, can we use the other convention? Like, you are using the up,
okay.
You're writing as 0, 1. Okay. But conventionally, we write it as 1, 0.
Okay, I can do that. Will everyone be comfortable using up as 1, 0 and down as 0, 1? Like, the other way around, which we use today, if that doesn't confuse me. Yeah, okay. I'll make that note down. So did you all get it as a mixed state? Just show me thumbs up if you're done. Great. Okay. I think I'll see you on Friday with the rest of the questions. There are some left. Yeah. There are some doubts.
Recording stopped.
And.